like it has a name in my D&D Beyond now. Its name is I should know this.
You should probably know.
It's Sledge.
Sledge, right. You had two whole sessions together. How could you forget?
Exactly. Live from the Mundangerous Undermountain in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 235 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're talking about building and surviving mega dungeons. But first, the party gets a letter in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, the Dungeoneer delves into the depths in the Character Creation Forge.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you this week by D&D Beyond. D&D Beyond is the official digital toolset and game companion for Dungeons & Dragons.
You can use it to build characters, track campaigns, run adventures, and do so much more.
It also has lots of awesome free content, like the D&D Basic Rules and articles from great writers like James J. Heck and awesome videos from Todd Kenrick.
The team is always updating the site with new features, so improvements to the platform are always coming. Like, for example, that Extras tab, where you can add all the different like sub categories like your Artificer Homunculus and your Wild Shape and all that. Mm-hmm. Shane, we are playing in Dark Sun. We've talked about this before, and yes. I have begun undertaking the ridiculous task that I should not do, but of course I am doing, of adding all the creatures that my 8th level druid is capable of wild shaping into, and then figuring out Dark Sun equivalents and renaming them all in D&D Beyond, which you can do.
So I will give you a pro tip. That's a fool's errand. You should just look at the two or three at each CR that are actually worth using. And then you can add them on the fly as filterable things when you need something that has like a specialty like swim or fly or something like that.
I am 100% sure that I will begin by doing that.
Given enough time, eventually you will adopt all of them.
And of course, I can just delete everything with a swim speed.
Right.
Because it's Dark Sun. There's no water.
It's a silt swim speed.
Well, that's what I'm gonna lobby for.
Yeah.
It's a silktopus. Silktopus.
So, yeah, that's it.
This is very gritty. Did we wash this well enough? I don't know.
I like when we built my Battlesmith, everybody was like, oh, well, what's the equivalent of an ape? Because I wanted, you know, like a mecha ape as my Battlesmith steel defender. And then we looked it up and it turns out it's just ape.
It's just an ape, right. There's still apes. Like tiny pockets of forest.
Yeah. So I have an ape. And it's named in, like, it has a name in my D&D Beyond now. Its name is I should know this.
You should probably know.
It's Sledge.
Sledge. Right. You had two whole sessions together. How could you forget?
Exactly. How could you forget all the Forge terms you know that have been thrown around three character sheets? Sledge, hammer, anvil. All I got.
All right. So if that sounds fun to you, check it out at dndbeyond.com.
Also, if you want to check it out on our YouTube channel, you can see our unboxing video of Beetle and Grimm's Baldur's Gate Ascent into Avernus Platinum Edition. This is the $500 premium box set in which you get minis and maps and a whole bunch of like extra stuff for running the adventure, DMs, two DM screens. But we pull all that stuff out of the box. We look at all of it. The camera kind of missed on the second angle, so it's not as good as the first Saltmarsh one, but we'll improve it for the next one, which is Eberron.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. You did bring the, I won't spoil too much, but the mini, which really should be called a maxi, mm-hmm. To our actual game, our Dark Sun game, last session, and just mm-hmm. plunked it on the table, and like plunked it because it's big.
It comes in three pieces.
And GM Angela looked at it and said, all right, I got to figure out how to work that in. Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
So check that out on our YouTube. There's a link in the show notes. You can search Total Party Thrill on YouTube. We have a playlist that includes both of the unboxing videos as well as a playlist of the full Stream of Blades campaign if you want to see our Band of Blades actual play. So Ishan, where are we in the Gates of Morning campaign?
The Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And on the day of mourning, near a barren stretch of a Carnathy battlefield, the party has died. Because, of course, they were killed in the wake of the destruction of Seer. But then, somehow, the party awoke, alive, in the House Durasco compound where they died, apparently raised back to life by the halflings of the House of Healing.
With us are the Ondarian soldiers that we were working with trying to save some refugees, though none of the refugees that we were trying to rescue have been revivified. Apparently they were in too many pieces.
They don't have that many HP. You know, that's how that works.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they were at the bottom of the compound, so all the rocks fell on them.
Right.
Yeah, rocks fell and you died, but you were mostly on the rocks.
They broke our fall.
So Colonel Darian Ephraim, all the Ondarians, thanks the party and tells them to call on him if they ever need any help. And then they all go their separate ways.
So 4.5 years later, each of us receives a letter from Colonel Ephraim. A House Orion courier delivers the message even to people with no fixed address or far from civilization, not unlike Warden and Bramble, who live on the edge of the Eldian Reach.
Yes, because in the intervening 4.5 years, they've returned to their groves, and yet a House Orion human mail delivery courier just sort of shows up one day and is like, "You are hard to find. Here's a letter."
Yeah. Thank you. You may go now. Lose my address.
Never had it to begin with. So everyone else in the party has been up to stuff too. Zan has been scavenging through old battlefields left over from the last war, and of course those are all over the place.
Yet Lucky the Changeling has been traveling around Corvair incognito in a variety of personalities.
I'm pretty sure that was just so that Susie, each time you guys entered a new city, could say, "Do I know someone here?" Yes. I know someone here, don't I? Of course I do.
Can I roll a D100 for this?
Vesica the Kalishtar has been working as a Brelish diplomat while searching for his long-lost brother.
Lenore has been working as an inquisitive in Sharn.
And Decimus has been also working tirelessly in his lab, probably doing something terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the letter that everyone gets reads the same thing. It says, "The 27th of Barakas, 998 YK. The years have not been kind to me, dear friend. The dreams. Does the war still burn on your blood as it does in mine? When last we met, I said you could call on me for a favor, but I am the one in need now. Will you help a comrade in arms? Meet me on the 11th of Ron at Marrow's Mead in Vedekir. If bonds do not bring you, I have crowns to make it worth the while."
And included in the letter is a one-way lightning rail ticket, good for passage from anywhere in Corvair to Vedekir, a small city in the heart of Carnath that is the ancestral seat of House Durasco.
It is also kind of close to that original battlefield where everybody died 4.5 years ago.
So tell me about the dates, Ishan, because I think that is perhaps the least decipherable to me, even as a player who played this. But I think what you're saying is it's roughly spring and we have 14 days to get to Vedekir.
It is late August and you have 14 days to get to Vedekir.
What's the difference between late August and spring?
So yeah, the Eberron is one of those fantasy settings where they rename all the months, but the months are still the same.
Mm-hmm.
And the campaign opened on the 20th of Olerun, which is February 20th, which is the day of mourning. Barakas is August 27th, and you are supposed to meet in Vedekir on the 11th of September.
I did not realize that. Was that a thing?
It was a thing I slipped in, yeah. I was like, okay. Let's make it the 11th of September. Why not?
Great.
We'll find out what happens next week, but definitely all of you go to Vedekir, because I think when we first started this campaign, I was like, here's really the only thing I need from you. Build a character who will respond to a letter requesting help from an old comrade.
Yeah. Sweet.
All right, so this week we are talking about Mega Dungeons.
Mega Dungeons.
It's a robot made of dungeons who kills other dungeons and then takes their powers, right?
It's 1,000 times a dungeon.
Oh, obviously. Okay.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense.
Yep. So this topic was suggested to us by FarmGoat on our Discord. Of course, there's a link in the show notes.
Which means that if you are on Discord, keep those ideas coming. And if you are not on Discord with us, come on over and keep those ideas coming.
And before we start kind of talking about Mega Dungeons, I do want to give a shout out to a name that we say in almost every episode, James Heck, one of the writers over at D&D Beyond. He wrote an article about Mega Dungeons back at the end of 2018. It is very good. It talks a lot about the Temple of Elemental Evil, as well as the Undermountain, the Dungeon of the Mad Mage. Very good. I did not crib his notes, but I would definitely recommend it to anybody who's interested in this. He did a great job with that. So with that in mind, link in the show notes, and then let's talk about, Ishan, what is a Mega Dungeon?
Well, it is a dungeon crawl adventure, or a series of adventures that takes place pretty much entirely inside a gigantic dungeon.
Yeah, so this stands in contrast to the dungeon crawl, which we talked about in episode 199, where, like, you're just taking the scale up, right? Like, it's not about, you know, a trip into the dungeon or a single purpose in this dungeon. It is a dungeon that is attached to a dungeon that is attached to a dungeon that is multiple pages in your maps and notes, and, like, it's a lot.
Right, like, the adventure is in the dungeon, right? Like, a traditional dungeon crawl, we all know the Tomb of Horrors plot, right? You get a hook to visit a dungeon, but you're in town, and, like, there are people who are defined there, and now you've got to make the trip to the dungeon, and you've got to find it in the first place. You're going to fight through monsters and traps, usually in a, like, discrete areas inside that dungeon, or in a series of rooms that connect to each other through probably regular doors or secret tunnels, etc.
Right. You will eventually fight a boss or a, like, kind of sub-boss, you know, typically a bigger, badder monster that will sort of mark the end of your dungeon.
Yeah, you'll fight a Sararak in a game of Joust.
Right. And then you will, you know, collect the loot and scars along the way. When you finish it, you will leave, go back to town, sell your stuff, and hobo on down the road to the next dungeon.
All right, so how does a mega dungeon differ?
It's just one gigantic dungeon. There's not, like, a set standard here, but, like, I like to think of dungeons as, like, somewhere in the, like, 10 to 50 room range. You know, like, if you bought a single adventure that has a 50 room dungeon, like, that's probably multiple sessions. Mega dungeons are, like, hundreds of rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, when you start numbering rooms and you need to, like, you know, break out triple digits, and then you're starting the dungeon, you know, like, the first level has 100 rooms, like, that's a mega dungeon. A mega dungeon is, like, an entire story, an entire world, an entire layout, like, encapsulated in, like, a set of maps.
Right. If you can fit the entire map on a single page, then it is entirely useless and illegible because there are so many rooms.
Yeah. If you're fitting it on an entire page, you either have the biggest page of sheet of paper in the world, or it's not a mega dungeon. So I think, like, one of the hallmarks here, right, because, like, the dungeon is the point, right? Like, often there are multiple floors. The layouts tend to be very, like, labyrinthine, or other times they are very, like, artistic in their layout, right? Because I think, like, the mapping aspect of a mega dungeon is important. And in fact, sometimes it's kind of like the point. Like, to see how all the rooms kind of fit together and, like, the mosaic that it creates, or, like, the image of their shape and that sort of thing, like, I think is one of those kind of Easter egg things that people design mega dungeons to do, and, like, people map and play mega dungeons to discover.
I mean, you even remember that stuff from, like, The Legend of Zelda, right? Where you're like, oh, it's an eagle. This dungeon is an eagle. Cool.
Right.
All right. That means there must be another room over here.
Right.
Let's break in somehow. This is the original Diablo game. There's a town, and then there's just 15 layers of dungeon beneath you.
Yeah. Right. Before it got all procedurally generated.
Bah. All right. So in an actual setting, how does a mega dungeon come to be? Who makes these things?
So I think you have sort of the very D&D thing is, like, an act of madness or an act of devotion, right? Like, you just built it on a huge scale to glorify something or someone.
This is your, like, Temple of Elemental Evil. I am glorifying Tharizdun by making a giant crazy dungeon. Or it's Halaster who is glorifying, I guess, himself.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's definitely like the like under mountain.
Right.
is like that self-indulgence and madness, right? Right, like, it's right there in the title.
Like Dungeon of the Mad Mage. Right? Yeah. That's that guy. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Right. But like you have things like ziggurats and Dark Sun, right? Which are sort of in the same way, sort of temples to the sorcerer kings, right? But like you could easily turn a ziggurat into a mega dungeon, right?
Oh, totally. Like, you know, it's 1,000 feet on a side.
Yeah, it's 1,000 feet on a side. Above ground.
Like, right, yeah.
Who even knows what's below the city, right?
I would say tip of the iceberg, but none of you know what ice is.
Yeah.
But I guess it could also be a natural phenomenon, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, you could have an Underdark adventure that is effectively a mega dungeon, right? You go in one entrance of the Underdark and you come out the other side of the Underdark without ever having left, going room by room, you know, passage by passage. Like, that's a mega dungeon.
Yeah, same thing happens in Eberron in Kyber, and Kyber is sort of planned to be a place where you can have these kinds of adventures, right? You go beneath ground and then it doesn't necessarily follow the same rules of physics as like the regular material plane. You go in and out of demiplanes, or things can be larger on the inside than the outside. Like you can fit a mega dungeon in a smaller space than you think you would be able to fit, because inside everything's crazy. Like a Dalkeir's lair can be twisting and turning in non-Euclidean and have hundreds or thousands of rooms.
Right. And then you add like manifest zones and all the other things that happen in Eberron, and like, trust me, it's there.
Yeah.
This can also like kind of be more naturally occurring in like cavern networks, right? Especially in like an ancient world that has like a volcanic past, right? Like you could easily have a mega dungeon that is just carved out in the lava flow passages underneath the volcano, for example. Mm-hmm. Right. And like the dungeon is not necessarily like, you know, the whole thing wasn't constructed as a dungeon, but what you have ended up creating in your world is like a place that has an entrance, a whole variety of rooms and challenges and different denizens and ecologies, and then somewhere in the middle is that vault that you're looking for.
You could also have these built by an abandoned or lost civilization, and that this probably means that it had a purpose prior to being a dungeon,
right?
It was just a complex of rooms that has since fallen into disrepair. Like, I don't know, think about the New York City subway system after an apocalypse would be mm-hmm. very much like a mega dungeon. I mean, the New York City subway system right now
is an apocalypse.
Very much a mega dungeon.
It's a mega dungeon. It's literally falling apart.
But like the Mines of Moria in Lord of the Rings is a mega dungeon full of like goblins and traps, but it wasn't built like that originally, right? It was right. built as like a place for all the dwarves to live.
Well, until a Baelor showed up, right?
Hey, well, it was their fault.
Okay. I guess that's more the demon than a devil, right? So I guess it doesn't really tie back to last episode.
We'll get into that in the demon episode. Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think also like the really cool one for me is a lost city. Right. Like this is like the city that's been buried under sand or buried under the ocean or just buried under rubble, or like, you know, is maybe in a place that's so remote that it's effectively inaccessible. Like kind of depending on your setting. Right. Like you could like I'm thinking of like the end of all of the like Nathan Drake Uncharted series, like, you know, you go to Shangri-La, right, which is just a very, very remote place, gigantic, in the Himalayan mountains. And, like, because you can't fly there, kind of because of hand-waving, right, and, like, engines don't run up there, like, it's effectively a dungeon with an open sky.
Yeah, the city of Ohm, which is basically lost in the jungle and has been abandoned for a long time and now is just full of traps and evil spirits in Tomb of Annihilation.
Mm-hmm. Like, there's, you know, a giant city in Zendrick could be the same thing, right? Like, Kaladne in Dark Sun, if you find it, right? Like, that's probably a mega dungeon if you want it to be.
Right. The last half of every Mummy movie.
Right. Exactly. you know, Atlantis in Myth is a, you know, it's a lost city. If you were to find it, like, that could be your mega dungeon. Of course, you got to figure out how to breathe underwater. But otherwise, like, there you go. And then I think, like, the other place, like, if you bring it out of just fantasy, is, like, ships, like, capital ships make for great mega dungeons, especially, like, if they're crashed or derelict. But even if, you know, they're running and functioning, right? Like, the Death Star could easily be your mega dungeon. Mm-hmm. Like, you have that one insertion point, and you have to navigate this massive space station and all of its compartments and all of its, like, stormtroopers and officers and all of those things that, like, creep within its boundaries as you have to complete your mission on the Death Star.
Right. Or, like, this isn't a spoiler because it was in the trailer, but, like, the Death Star, after it has crash-landed, is now a mega dungeon on the inside, and it's, like, turned on its side, and so you have these, like, long corridors which are actually, like, falls to nowhere.
Yeah.
And none of the catwalks work because they're all vertical, and you've got corpses and crazy stuff inside, and then occasionally you exit this door, and where are you? In the middle of the ocean.
Right. Or, like... like the Force Awakens opens with a crash Star Destroyer on Jakku, right? And like Rey is gallivanting through it like a dungeon. That is of the scale that could easily work as a mega dungeon as well.
In 40K, obviously, you've got Space Hulks and other salvage, although maybe not salvageable, ships.
Yeah. like Salvation's Reach is another good one in 40K lore. That's in the Gaunt's Ghost series. It's basically like a high gravity like accumulation of space waste. So it's where Space Hulks go to like basically be pounded into slag metal by gravity. But because of that, like it's just a bunch of different compartments that like basically grow into each other, right? So like this piece of it might be like the remains of an Imperial capital ship, and this piece of it might just be like, you know, the remains of like an exoplanet or something.
Right, and then some of the denizens have begun carving between the two spaces to like create an airlock or whatever.
Right, exactly.
All right, so when you are playing a mega dungeon, how is this going to be different from a regular old dungeon delve?
Well, you want the players to feel a difference in scale. And mapping is the thing that I come back to on this. Like, we typically don't recommend mapping dungeons because it's, like, a lot of work and it's pretty easy to just abstract it, right, as a series of encounters. But here, like, the mapping is kind of the point. Like, you want that artifact of the adventure. Like, yeah, we cleared 300 rooms. Like, I want something to show for it, you know?
Yeah, I like the idea of, you know, someone pulls out graph paper. They're like, all right, I'm going to start drawing the map here. And you're like, start in the corner and you're going to need more pieces of paper.
Right.
Wait, what?
That's a good start for today.
Right.
We're going to need tape. Does anybody have tape?
Sort of thinking about it long term, like you said, you know, it's sort of bragging rights to be like, haha, there were 300 rooms. But like the map is the proof.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all drew it and it took days.
Yeah, right. And like we kept track of what was where so that we knew where we were going and where we could go back to and all of those things.
You can also telegraph this before they necessarily get in, right? A lot of preparation and planning is going to be required in order to go into this complex where, one, they may not be able to find, you know, food and water and magical supplies or whatever, but also are probably going to have a hard time finding safe places to rest as they work their way through hundreds of rooms of enemies.
Right. So, like, they need to think through, like, how many resources are they bringing with them? You know, like, are they bringing a train of pack animals? Are there hirelings or sidekicks that are going to be a part of this adventure? Like, it's can be very much like an expedition, you know? Like, a normal dungeon might take a day or two to clear. Like, a mega dungeon could take weeks or a month,
which is like if you actually play it all out, dozens of long rests.
Yeah.
Think about how you're going to resupply. And if it's inhabited, then the inhabitants probably have a way to figure out how to get food and water, unless of course like it's a, you know, inhabited by, you know, droids or undead, then right. You have bigger problems.
Yeah. Learn to eat droid.
It's delicious.
But if that's the case, right, like then you probably need to have some plan to either overcome or negotiate with them. Like, could very well be bringing trade goods, right? Like, mm-hmm. if you know, like, that there are kobolds in that dungeon, or there are, like, I guess Grung probably don't hang out in a dungeon, but maybe in the very early part of a dungeon, right? Like, you know, something where they have a cultural identity and, like, a cultural interest in goods, then bring them those goods, and maybe you can trade for supplies.
Yeah, I think this is probably one of the reasons why people like Under Mountain, or at least the idea of Under Mountain so much, is like you have no idea what's going to be there. Like you could have Grung. Why? Because Halaster was like, ah, needs some Grung here.
That's why people like me hate Under Mountain. It's because you have no idea what's going to be there and there's no reason for it.
There's that one overarching reason. Although I like the idea, though, of Halaster being like, yeah, I need some Grung. And then all the Grung just died.
Yeah.
Because like it's just not an environment that's conducive to them surviving.
Or like the Grung have taken over like the adjoining antechambers. Like they've driven out two sets of monsters neighboring them.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about that.
And then smart parties will want to think about safety. How are you going to stay safe? How are you going to leave if you have to? And ways to quickly bail out.
Yeah, so like overall, a mega dungeon is about attrition. Like if you're going to spend days or weeks in a dungeon, like you need to be able to rest, right? So you need to be able to secure a place to sleep for 8 hours. You need to know that you're safe. You might have to be able to set up like base camps in a way. You know, of like as you advance further into the dungeon, like you leave your hirelings and sidekicks with your supplies and like you venture out. And then once you like get a foothold further in, you like send for them and bring them forward, you know?
Yeah. What is the purpose of going into this dungeon? Are you here to just go in, get a thing and get out? Are you exploring? And so you do need to map the whole thing, or are you establishing basically a new perimeter of your society? You know, as you go in, are you saying, all right, we've taken this room, but before we move to the next one, we need to secure this room. And when we move to the next one, we don't let that security lapse on the rooms behind us.
Right, exactly. Like, you might be, like, establishing beachheads for an invasion of this dungeon. Or you might just need to have, like, a halo of safety, you know, behind you, a place that you can, like, kind of reliably go back to just to rest and keep your supplies.
Right, like, okay, now we'll pack up the rear guard and, like, we're giving up access to this here because we have to keep moving forward.
Yeah, and you have to think about that because you're there to loot, presumably, if you're, like, anybody else, like, any other D&D character, right? Like, what are you going to do with all that loot? Like, you can't just keep dragging it along to every new place, you know?
It's fine, we're not counting encumbrance.
Okay.
We're just ignoring it.
I pick up my 37th longsword. I am a witcher now.
It doesn't matter how much it weighs. We just need to arrange it in this grid.
Yeah. And then you also need to think about, like, if things go sideways in a fight, in a place, like, where can you run to escape that immediate threat? Right? Where's your regroup point? Where's your rally point? And then what happens if, like, you need to leave the entire dungeon? How do you get out of there in a pinch? What's your escape plan if we need to, like, throw the parachute and jump out?
Right. And does that mean there's no coming back and this is over?
Right.
Do you have one of these that you basically bargained your life away to get and that's it? And so you're only going to use it. Well, the person who can use it is only going to use it if they're about to die.
Right.
I like the idea of like a party sort of sitting down and planning their next move and really being like, how dangerous is this place now that we have experienced some of it? So that when we are in a life or death situation, we don't have to debate whether we open a door we haven't opened before and run through it to get away, or whether we have definitely decided it's better just to die here.
I mean, that's how you introduce the chase mechanic into your mega dungeon. Like, rocks fall behind you.
Also, big rolling boulder.
Yeah. Rocks chase you down the hall. Wait, what?
I think maybe one reason that people don't do mega dungeons more is that it feels like, or it can feel like, it's tough to tell a story, that you sort of fall back on combat mechanics and like the enumeration of what's in your character sheet. So how do you continue to propel plot and story forward when you're running a dungeon like this?
So I think there's sort of three stories that you tell at once with a mega dungeon. And this is true of a dungeon, but I think just because of scale, like you're able to tell a more like robust story as you go in a mega dungeon. So first is like the story of the PCs overcoming the dungeon, right? Which is kicking down doors, killing orcs, stealing their stuff. Then there's the story of the dungeon itself, right? Which is who built this? Why did they build it? How was it built? What happened here? How did it end up the way that it is, right? And like, why does this place exist?
Yeah, I think that's one of the strengths of Indiana Jones in general as like a story and in a genre is that he is a dungeon delver who is overcoming traps, but he is also an explorer and an archaeologist who understands the lore and is interested in the lore and wants to find out more about why this is here.
Right. And I think that's important because you need that reason to keep driving forward, you know, like just looking for the next shiny object, like then you're just going through a series of mechanics to see if you get there in time, you know? Whereas like if there's a story that the players are uncovering in the dungeon as they go deeper, like you want to keep pushing forward in order to get the next chapter, right?
Right. And then the loot that you find isn't just, you know, 250 gold art object, right? It is an actual like, you know, idol of the falcon goddess. And right. I know about this because I've like studied the lore of this civilization that was here 2,000 years ago.
Right. And then the third story that you tell in sequence or that you tell in parallel is the story of the inhabitants today, right? Which is who lives here now? Why do they live here? And like, how have they changed the environment for themselves? You know, like they can erase some of the history and introduce more mysteries, but they can also like change the way that like the physical landscape looks, the way that like passages work, you know, like the dungeon might be damaged in that way, which might create opportunity for you as adventurers, but also like might make it that you have to take the long way now, you know, like that passage is caved in or whatever.
And in a mega dungeon with hundreds of rooms, you're going to be telling a bunch of stories like this. Each sort of area of the dungeon, whether that's like naturally created or it's determined by how much of the dungeon your party has been able to like gain control of, is going to end up like a vignette of a particular story. So the story that you're learning from or telling about the kobolds on level 2 may have no interaction with the story of drow refugees on level 5, but they also might inform each other. Things you learned on level 2 might be helpful on level 5.
Right. And especially like things that you learned about the dungeon on level 2, right? Like, and the things you learn about the dungeon on level 5, like, should be kind of telling that holistic story of why was this built, right? And so that's sort of the, like, in, like, an episodic structure, like, that's what's sort of the through line that's pulling everything together.
Yeah, I think that's probably the main reason that I enjoy these large constructions, because they do have to tell such a large story. Like, I like the idea of the thing that we learned on level 5 with the drow, it actually helps us open the door on level 2 that we could not get into, and we hit it on the way back.
Right. Or, if you're our group, you turn around immediately.
Yeah.
Figure out what's behind that door.
Wait, it's probably a key in there that we need, or like a key card of some kind to open up a different door.
Right. So I hinted on this in like episodic structure, right? But like, I think that's the key here, is you want to structure... like the storytelling should be episodic, framed around the inhabitants that you're dealing with in this area, right? So like if you think of like, you know, as like a TV show, right? Like for the next couple sessions, we're telling the story of how we dealt with the kobolds, right? Like that's the episode we're on now. But like as you go from the kobolds onto the goblins, onto the drow, onto the undead, right? Like each of these episodes is teaching us stuff about the dungeon. And we're learning about like this place and who created it in the process.
And each episode, no matter who, no matter which inhabitants are the current focus, then gives the party a bit more information about the dungeon itself, which is going to be useful in future episodes, no matter who you're dealing with.
I think as you're planning these kind of like episodes, right, like effectively sections of the dungeon, like ask yourself kind of two questions. What is the challenge here, right? What are you expecting? How are you planning to threaten or make it difficult for the PCs? And then what should they be learning here in the process? Like what are they meant to discover as they go through this section?
I think a lot of dungeons sort of lampshade the discovery by giving you items or tokens that you can discover. And after a while, the party begins to realize, oh, wait, we found three of these tiles with, you know, animal glyphs on them, and we keep finding them. Now, what do they mean, right? Rather than necessarily figuring out something about the kind of stonework that whoever built this used, or, you know, the religious iconography that these particular chaos cultists use, and, you know, maybe we'll put that together in the future. But like, hey, we've acquired 6 stone tablets, huh? And we didn't find one on this level. How does that matter? Is that important?
Mm-hmm.
Just like your regular campaign outside of the mega dungeon, these episodes can vary pretty widely in, you know, the subject, the sort of main gist of what the party is dealing with in a particular episode, as well as their length and the amount of challenge involved. This is, you know, you're telling an overarching story just like in a regular campaign. And right now we're telling a story that's happening in this particular village, which may not have anything to do with what's happening in another village right now. But there is an underlying issue happening across the continent.
Right. And I think it's important, like, to vary the challenge as well. You know, like, you can't just have a dungeon in which, like, a mega dungeon in which you have that, like, kind of classical, like, escalating difficulty, right? Like, when you have, like a Sunless Citadel, right, which is sort of like a 50-room dungeon, like, sure, you enter as level 1, you will have enough fights that by the end you will be level 3 or 4, and therefore you need a higher level threat at the bottom. But that's because you're going through and you're fighting your whole way through. But, like, if you string 5 Sunless Citadels together, then, like, you can't just have a level 15 threat at the end, you know? Like, at some point, they need a break. An easy portion, or, like, the, you know, the chance to catch their breath and do, like, some role-playing, or do some, like, a little more, like, social interaction or survival interaction will, like, be a welcome breath of fresh air from just kicking down every single door and fighting whatever's on the other side.
And then, you know, you'll tie all these different sections of the dungeons together through the story, you know? So the kobolds want that trinket back that previous adventurers stole from them. And in return, they'll offer to guide you all through the next section with all of the hobgoblins, which is pretty dangerous.
Right. And then, of course, like, classically, like, any shortcuts or bypasses that you take, like, might carry a little bit greater risk. You know, there's a giant chasm that you have to cross in here in order to, like, take the shortcut. How do you do that?
Yeah, there's all the risk of the gold that we didn't get.
Uh-huh.
Left all those doors unopened.
The true risk.
All right, let's talk about pacing. You touched on this a little bit, but, you know, like you said, you can't just have it be like a go, 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 1 to 2 session level of action that you might have when you're just running through a 50-room dungeon.
Right. So I think the key is to pace for what it is about this mega dungeon that excites the players to play in it.
Yeah, is this going to be their own story that, you know, they've informed with their backstories and they've created a name for their adventuring company and now they're heading into this mega dungeon because they're, whatever, going to conquer it or, you know, get all this money because they're, you know, a team of amazing gallant swashbucklers.
Yeah, like Door Kickers Incorporated, they're telling you what they're going to be doing. And so when you pace that, right, like, you want to build tension as their resources are dwindling. Right. And you want to make sure that, like, you are consistently pushing them to the limit of their capability and then giving them a chance to breathe in and, like, regroup. Right.
Yeah. It can be sort of difficult to gauge exactly how close to the edge your party should be, but, you know, keep them close there, but not there forever.
You want them on that knife edge, like, in high leverage situations. Right. Like, that's the key. But, like you said, it can't be forever. Like, you want them starting their story with, like, so there we were, 6 levels underground. We hadn't eaten in 3 days. We hadn't slept in 2. Our water skins are nearly empty. Ragnar has a broken leg. And we're being harassed by the ugliest goblins you've ever seen that were still mad because we kidnapped their pet parrot. And then this happened. You know? Like, you want that kind of moment for those players because that's what they've signed up for.
Yeah, keep bringing them near the edge of despair. Make them think, or at least ponder, do we leave now? Is now the time when we abandon this whole thing? And then when you pull them back out, that just means that the next time they're in dire circumstances, they're going to want to keep pushing forward too.
They're that much more tempted because they got that much more loot.
Right. And also, you don't want to, like, have prepared hundreds of rooms of a mega dungeon and then have them be like, nah, this is too tough. We're leaving. Forget this.
Right. Exactly.
Level 2? No way. The party could also be interested in learning more about the current denizens, whether that is due to research or maybe they have to know more about them because they're the key to some other kind of quest and that has brought them to the mega dungeon in the first place.
Yeah, like if this is what they're interested in, right? Like if all this dungeon ecology and like and inhabitants are interesting, like let them live with them and spend time with those groups. Like there's no rush, you know. Like if you take a week in the relative safety of like a group of like Dwergar, relative safety,
yeah.
Like in order to like accomplish something, right? Like great, like that's fine. That's still part of a dungeon.
This can be right after those big action sequences, right? And actually, that might make the party more amenable to trying to parlay or just living and being an inhabitant of the mega dungeon for a little while. And then, you know, that surfaces other kinds of quests like, oh, you're, you know, having trouble with another group of denizens down here. Maybe we can sort of broker a truce, or we can be the muscle, or maybe we can answer some questions, or like build things for you. Or this is where those trade goods come into use, right?
Like, yeah.
We brought you seeds. You don't have these plants down here.
Right.
Can you imagine the kind of like power you could build, the power base you could build by beginning agriculture with these down here?
Right. Or like, you know, the easiest way through is that way, but that's a holy site and the high priest will not let you through. And now like your challenge is one, you can fight the entire community, of course, or assassinate the high priest, or like maybe it's about like convincing them or doing something for them or like ousting them politically, right? And now you're solving a dungeon, you're solving a problem in a dungeon, but you're not just kicking down doors.
Right. I roll for a miracle, of course.
Yeah.
Divine intervention. Not so holy anymore, is it? I unhallow. Don't worry, I fixed it.
Well, hey, that might be a problem that you're fixing. You might have to hallow it again for them.
Right.
Because another adventuring group, the single greatest threat in the dungeon, has already come through here, stolen a ton of the loot, and then also screwed over these poor Dwergar.
Just these poor Dwergar. But like, yes, to your point, a mega dungeon offers these kinds of long tail opportunities that you don't usually get in a regular sized dungeon. Like think about Sunless Citadel. You've got kobolds who are fighting these goblins and yeah, you can play them off against each other or like even get hired by the kobolds. But that's really a one-off thing where they're actually like, hey, do us a favor and go handle the threat two doors over.
Right, exactly. Like, okay, I'm on my way anyway.
Why would I not get paid for that? Sure.
Right.
Oh, we got hurt a lot. It's okay. We're one level down. We'll go upstairs and rest, and then we'll come right back.
And then I think if the players are most interested in learning about the dungeon itself, especially as they go further into the dungeon, like I think you want to change the pacing so that they're encountering fewer living things. And they're learning kind of more and more in each room that they enter, right? Like you kind of want to like accelerate the pacing at the end to keep them excited.
Yeah. And I would say this actually even holds true if the mega dungeon is actually a kind of lair, like we talked about before in Eberron, in Kyber, you might, be infiltrating the lair or be trapped in the lair of a Dalkeir. And if you think about it, that you would think that the further in you get, the more monsters there would be because they're sort of emanating from the Dalkeir. But in a lair or like a death store or whatever, actually, when you get closer to like the throne room or the base of power, it is kind of likely that there will be fewer things that you encounter because this is supposed to be a safe space that doesn't need to be guarded. So it'll make sense that even if you get deeper in, the challenges become maybe more cerebral, or you meet fewer things, but you meet more things that you can parlay with, or things that are intrigued to meet you from the outside.
Yeah, and like that's always the thing too. Like, you know, if a beholder is at the center of the dungeon, right? Like in Dalkeir, like nobody is going into the beholder's tunnels. Like, there's a radius in which that beholder is going to operate, and you don't want to be in it. So, like, I think you can shift towards, like, puzzles and traps and environmental complications here, but what you don't want to do is, like, make them very complicated problems just because they're deeper in. You know, like, you want them to kind of like, oh, cool, like, one spell solves this problem. We cast the spell and we keep moving because, like, we're at the end. Like, we want to go. We want to find out what's around the next corner because, like, we're learning about this and the story of this dungeon is compelling.
Yeah, and it's harder to refresh those abilities anyway. So the cost of using those abilities the deeper you go in is naturally higher anyway, even if, like, on paper, it's still, like, a third level spell slot.
Right.
Now, one of the reasons that we sometimes say that you should avoid mapping out a dungeon is so that you can change stuff.
Yeah, so you can cheat.
Because until the players have actually drawn it on their maps, it exists in a state where it hasn't yet, you know, coalesced into dungeon form.
Yeah, like a quantum state.
Right.
So the player's observation is what makes it so. So, yeah, I think, like, you know, sometimes, especially when you get into, like, the, like, physical shape of the dungeon, you might have some constraints that you have to work within on this. But, like, for the most part, like, you can probably switch rooms, move some encounters, or, like, completely erase encounters in order to, like, suit the pacing of the players. You know, like, if it's less interesting for them to just get curb stomped by, like, a pack of orcs on the other side of this door because they're pushing too far and too hard, like, maybe sandbag that encounter or, like, move those orcs later and, like, give them a chance or a warning or something that would, like, give them a reason to rest and prepare a little bit more so that you're not just, like, TPKing your players on level 3 out of 7.
Yeah, and I think this is probably true, where, like, players and GMs who are more interested in a kind of OSR old school style game will be more attracted to a mega dungeon. But I would suggest that you've already done so much prep, and let's be honest, you're probably not creating this mega dungeon yourself, like writing it all out, right? You are probably adapting something from somewhere else or using some sort of like randomly generated table or whatever. I highly suggest that you feel free to edit things or to change things, especially if it's random, right? It may not necessarily like make sense, or it may not actually make for good fun gameplay. But also, if you're running someone else's like 40 page mega dungeon, like tweak things for your player's capabilities or for the play style of your game or for how long your sessions are, right? Because people don't want to stop 1 hour before the session ends, so they might just be more foolhardy, or they might end up being more cautious and ramp it up. Why not?
So, yeah, I think just because it's a mega dungeon doesn't mean that what's written down has to be any more sacred than anything else that you plan in any other adventure. It's just a little bit harder to move things on the map. Like, if you can keep the shape of the rooms the same, that'll help you a little bit. Well, do you hear that, Ishin?
Is that the little scratchy scratch of scarab beetles? Oh, no. How did they survive down here for this long? What have they been eating?
Well, I think they've been eating our last set of adventurers, so it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge and roll up a new batch. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous, that's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishin at Evil Sends Carne, that's Malice minus Meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
And I suppose there are some people who don't know what Discord is. Discord is a chat app that is used primarily by gaming communities. It's got like voice chat and, you know, type chat and all the usual stuff.
It's like Slack.
it's like IRC. But yeah, it's basically that. And because of that, lots of people have gathered on Discord. So if you want to join us there, that is where we hang out most of the day, slacking off from work. So if you want to come join our community there, there's a link in the show notes.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you this week by Kobold Press. Do you love Kobold Press 5th Edition Adventures? Well, now you can get some of their best ones on Fantasy Grounds, including Courts of the Shadow Fae, an adventure for 7th to 10th level characters that contains 100 NPCs, a map with more than 60 locations of the courts, and more than 40 combat and role-playing encounters. I think that means it's not technically a mega dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
If you slap two of them together, though.
That's true. It will take you from the mortal world to the Hearts of Shadow. Or check out Necropolis of the Mailed Fist, a punishing one-session tournament dungeon for 8th-level characters. Monsters and constructs guarding the necropolis can overwhelm the careless or unwary. The traps and hazards protecting its relics can slay an adventurer who makes a single misstep.
Curses are everywhere, along with dangers that can destroy magic items, which is the worst curse of all.
Everything you need to play is loaded up and ready to go in a sleek virtual table on Fantasy Grounds.
Hey, Shane, maybe we could play a mega dungeon online on Fantasy Grounds. Maybe that's how we could get everyone together, and we could do it while we're all at work.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I'll send out the invite right now.
Nice. All right, so to find out more, you can go to fantasygrounds.com and tell them DSPN sent you. So this week in the Character Creation Forge, Shane, we're building the Dungeoneer. Tell us all about the Dungeoneer.
The Dungeoneer is a dungeon delver who was born to go into dungeons and do dungeoning.
That makes sense. Were they chosen by a magic ring and by your thieves' tools combined, I am Captain Dungeon?
No. That's the Planeteers.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Well, tell you what. What's the build?
The build is Assassin Rogue 7, Gloomstalker Ranger 3, War Magic Wizard 10.
I'll tell you right now, this is very similar. I think we're on the same wavelength to a build that I was putting together to like potentially go through Tales from the Yawning Portal.
Mm.
Oh, you end with Tomb of Horrors. So,
mm-hmm. Yep.
Is this also the first appearance in the Character Creation Forge of the Dungeon Delver feat?
It is the first appearance in the Character Creation Forge of the Dungeon Delver feat.
Well, it makes sense here because it gives you advantage on perception and investigation checks to find secret doors, advantage on saving throws versus traps, and resistance to damage from those traps if you do fail.
And then you also have no passive perception penalty for traveling at a fast pace, which I actually forgot was even a thing. So good for you, feet.
Yeah, same. Also, don't travel at a fast pace through a dungeon.
Right.
I mean, I guess if you're running away, run away!
This is also the first appearance of the Dwarf Mark of Warding race, Ishin.
Wow. I like this thematically. So Mark of Warding, as with normal dwarves, you get dark vision, advantage on saves versus poison, and resistance to poison damage, which is great because traps, so many traps use poison damage.
Uh-huh.
Poison needles, cloud kills, etc. Stone cunning, extremely useful because it gives you expertise on history checks related to stonework, and many, many dungeons are made of stone.
And then you get, from the Mark of Warding, you get Warder's Intuition, which is a extra D4 on investigation and thieves' tools checks.
And then Wards and Seals lets you cast Alarm, Mage Armor, and Arcane Lock once per day. Now, this is usually to keep people out, but honestly, in a dungeon, the thing you want to do every single night is secure the perimeter.
Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. That's a big theme for this build. From your spells of the mark, you will add to your spell list Alarm, Armor of Agathys, Arcane Lock, and I think Knock is an underrated spell here. Just the ability to open doors that are, you know, sealed. And then we're really here for Glyph of Warding and Magic Circle, both good defensive spells. And then my personal favorites are Lehman's Secret Chest, a 4th-level spell, which is typically, you know, people like use it to get loot out, you know, turn a chest into send it into Hammerspace and then keep the little replica with you. But I think it's great for packing in supplies. Like, you can load up on food, you can load up on anything you need inside this chest, and then transport it with a little replica, access it whenever you need it. And then you'll get Mordenkainen's Faithful Hound, which is a hound that does security for you while you sleep. But what's handy is it doesn't just start barking when there's an intruder. It'll actually attack.
Right. So...
And it hurts. Like, at the, you know, at the end of the day, if you have an extra 4th-level slot, like 48 damage on a hit is, that's a pretty good, like, just free extra little ability for something that's bothering you while you sleep.
I mean, you're long resting, right? So you're getting that slot bag anyway.
Exactly.
So Gloomstalker Ranger gives you a favorite enemy. If you can do some research before you head into the dungeon, you might be able to figure out what you should pick. Natural Explorer, probably Underdark or Mountain, depending on the terrain of this dungeon. And Archery fighting style, because everything is dangerous and you want to attack it from range.
Then you will also know 3 first level Ranger spells. I think Hunter's Mark is probably a go-to, but like you can take a look at some of the utility stuff on the level 1 Ranger list.
Dread Ambusher gives you Wisdom 2 initiative, which is going to be great when you finally do get into the fight. It'll give you 10 feet of additional movement in the first round, and then you can make 2 attacks in the first round rather than just 1.
Yeah, on your extra attack, you'll do an extra D8 damage if you hit.
And then we're really here for Umbral Sight, which increases your dark vision to 90 feet, and then you are invisible to creatures that use dark vision. Very, very common underground.
Yeah, you are a very, very sneaky dwarf.
What are you trying to say about dwarves, Shane?
Not traditionally sneaky. I said it.
All right, fine. Fine, we'll let that pass, but we'll bring it up at the next council meeting.
Okay.
War Magic Wizard, 10. You get 5th level spells, all the utility slots. Please, please. That's the main thing you want down here. You don't want to be chucking fireballs in close quarters.
Yeah, and then also just like your build is like an alpha striking rogue from range. Like you don't need to be throwing in a bunch of like combat spells as well. You want to get through the challenges as cheaply for the team as possible.
And then one of my favorite abilities for a dungeon delver actually is the level 2 ability from War Magic Wizard, Arcane Deflection, which as a reaction you can give yourself +2 to AC or +4 to a saving throw anytime. Like just as a reaction. It doesn't get used up. There's no limited uses. The only drawback is that you can only cast cantrips until the end of your next turn, but that's fine. You're shooting a bow.
Right. Then you will also get Tactical Wit, which adds your intelligence to initiative. You don't necessarily have to have a high intelligence for this build because you're not going to force too many saving throws or make too many spell attacks, but still, like, between wisdom and intelligence to your initiative, like you're gonna go first.
Yeah, 3 stats to initiative.
Right. And the 3 stats you're gonna take. And then you at level 6, you get Power Surge. So every time you counterspell or dispel magic, you will gain a Power Surge up to like your intelligence modifier. And then on a hit, you can expend one of these surges to deal up to 5 points of extra damage. That's half your wizard level.
And then, at level 10, Durable Magic. While you are concentrating on a spell, you get +2 to AC and saving throws, which basically stacks with everything, and there are so many spells that you just always want to be concentrating on.
Yeah, I mean, it just like your basic level 1 Hunter's Mark is concentration, mm-hmm. right? So, like, you throw that up at the beginning of the fight, and now you got +2 bonus to AC and saves. Like, you're in good shape.
Assassin Rogue gives you 4 expertises. You're going to want Investigation and Perception, of course. 4d6, Sneak Attack, Cunning Action, and you can assassinate, which means you get advantage on creatures who haven't acted in the first round of combat, and you are going to crit on anyone you hit who is surprised.
So with +3 stats to your to your initiative, I feel like you're going to be able to use your assassinate in every fight. You will also get Disguise Kit and Poisoner's Kit proficiency. And then what we're really here for is Uncanny Dodge and Evasion that will reduce the damage on attack rolls, as well as when you make Dexterity saves, you will take half on a fail and 0 damage on a success. So in terms of leveling order, we're of course going to start Rogue 1. I think you then want to take your Gloomstalker levels. This is a tough one because you need to get that you need to get your dungeon delver feat at some point, and so like the longer you go, like the less you're gonna feel like a dungeon delver, even though it's not really that great. So like I would probably do it that way. And then start taking some wizard levels, finish rogue, finish wizard. I don't know exactly where to split those wizard levels. It's kind of based on like what are you seeing in the dungeon and what are the tools that you need in your toolkit in order to overcome them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'd probably definitely go at least to wizard 2 and pick up Arcane Deflection, maybe even further to grab the ASI.
Yeah. Before we wrap up, let's take a moment to thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
You can also leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It's the best way to support the show and help other people find us. If you do, we will read it on the air. So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
Well, Picard is back, and so I think it is finally time to talk about playing in the Star Trek universe. I know it's your favorite, Shane.
It is, and Picard is my favorite lady.
Yeah, she has those buns in her hair, right? Princess Picard.
That's what's on all the advertisements. I don't know what to tell you. And in the character creation forge?
We're building Section 31.
I don't know what this is. But that's it for episode 235 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Total Party Thrill is also brought to you this week by Hero Forge. Hero Forge has a new Kickstarter out right now, running until February 13th, for color options on your printing.
Hey, do you hate painting? Me too. This way, yes. You can just get them pre-printed with color, either right into the actual mini, like the plastic is colored itself, or you can design them online, add your own colors, and then they will be sent to a professional artist who will hand paint it.
Yep, you know the deal with Hero Forge. You get to design and customize your mini, any pose, any items, whatever they have, any race, any gender, whatever you would like to see on your mini. Well, now you can do that in color. With their online color design tool, you can virtually paint your mini after you've created it. You can add color tones for skin, fur, metal, glass, all those types of things. You can add dry brushing and washing and inking effects, and even mix custom colors.
You can use the color design tool like a paint planner, so you can try out the colors, see what they look like before you actually send it out to get painted or have it printed.
Or, if you're like me and paint your own minis, you can kind of like test what colors it's going to look like before you start painting.
Super handy. There's also a token maker for the virtual tabletop, which lets you design and export tokens in full color, either as portrait or top-down view.
So, the Kickstarter closes February 13th, and they begin updating their library of thousands of parts for full color compatibility. In May of 2020, they will finalize a user interface for the color app and launch the beta. And then in June 2020, they will open order submission for 3D printed color and hand painted miniatures and start fulfillment.
And we will finally get our hands on some and be broke, I guess. I guess we'll be broke.
Because there goes all my money.
I guess we could just pay them the money they gave us for this ad.
Yeah.
We could at least spend that.
Passing it right back to them. So check that out over on Kickstarter or at heroforge.com.